Chapter 14. Meditations of Luke. Mrs. Church, Amy Gibbs's aunt, was definitely an unpleasant woman. Her sharp nose, shifty eyes, and her voluble tongue all alike filled Luke with nausea. He adopted a curt manner with her and found it unexpectedly successful. "What you've got to do," he told her, "is to answer my questions to the best of your ability. If you hold back anything or tamper with the truth, the consequences may be extremely serious to you."
"Yes, sir, I see. Are you sure I'm only too willing to tell you anything I can? I've never been mixed up with the police."
"And you don't want to be," finished Luke. "Well, if you do as I've told you, there won't be any question of that. I want to know all about your late niece, who her friends were, what money she had, anything she said that might be out of the way. We'll start with her friends. Who were they?" Mrs. Church leered at him slyly out of the corner of an unpleasant eye.
"You'll be meaning gentlemen, sir."
"Had she any girlfriends?"
"Well, hardly to speak of, sir. Of course, there was girls as she'd been in service with, but Amy didn't keep up with them much, you see.
She preferred the sterner sex. Go on, tell me about that."
"It was Jim Harvey down at the garage she was actually going with, sir, and a nice steady young fellow he was. You couldn't do better, I've said to her many a time,"
Luke cut in. "And the others?" Again he got the sly look.
"I expect you're thinking of the gentleman who keeps the curiosity shop. I didn't like it myself, and I tell you that straight, sir. I've always been respectable, and I don't hold with carryings on. But with what girls are like nowadays, it's no use speaking to them. They go their own way, and often they live to regret it."
"Did Amy live to regret it?" asked Luke bluntly.
"No, sir. That I do not think.
She went to consult Dr. Thomas on the day of her death. That wasn't the reason."
"No, sir. I'm nearly sure it wasn't. Oh, I'd take my oath on it. Amy had been feeling ill and out of sorts, but it was just a bad cough and a cold she had. It wasn't anything of the kind you suggest. I'm sure it wasn't, sir."
"I'll take your word for that. How far had matters gone between her and Ellsworthy?" Mrs. Church leered.
"I couldn't say exactly, sir. Amy wasn't one for confiding in me."
Luke said curtly, "But they'd gone pretty far." Mrs. Church said smoothly,
"The gentleman hasn't got at all a good reputation here, sir. All sorts of goings-on, and friends down from town, and many very queer happenings up in the witch's meadow, in the middle of the night."
"Did Amy go?"
"She did go once, sir, I believe. Stayed out all night, and his lordship found out about it. She was at the manor then, and spoke to her pretty sharp, and she sauced him back, and he gave her notice for it, which was only to be expected."
"Did she ever talk to you much about what went on in the places she was in?"
Mrs. Church shook her head. "Not very much, sir. More interested in her own doing, she was."
"She was with Major and Mrs. Horton for a while, wasn't she?"
"Nearly a year, sir."
"Why did she leave?"
"Just to better herself. There was a place going at the manor, and of course the wages were better there."
Luke nodded. "She was with the Hortons at the time of Mrs. Horton's death?" he asked.
"Yes, sir.
She grumbled a lot about that, with two hospital nurses in the house and all the extra work nurses make, and the trays and one thing and another." "She wasn't with Mr. Abbott, the lawyer, at all?"
"No, sir. Mr. Abbott has a man and wife to do for him. Amy did go to see him once at his office, but I don't know why."
Luke stored away that small fact as possibly relevant. Since Mrs. Church, however, clearly knew nothing more about it, he did not pursue the subject. "Any other gentlemen in the town who were friends of hers?"
"Nothing that I'd care to repeat."
"Come now, Mrs. Church, I want the truth, remember."
"It wasn't a gentleman, sir. Very far from it. Demeaning herself, that's what it was, and so I told her."
"Do you mind speaking more plainly, Mrs. Church?"
"You'll have heard of the Seven Stars, sir. Not a good class house, and the landlord, Harry Carter, a low class fella, and half seas over most of the time."
"Amy was a friend of his?"
"She went a walk with him once or twice."
"I don't believe there was more in it than that."
"I don't indeed, sir."
Luke nodded thoughtfully and changed the subject. "Did you know a small boy, Tommy Pierce?"
"What, Mrs. Pierce's son? Of course I did. Always up to mischief."
"He ever see much of Amy?"
"Oh no, sir.
Amy would soon send him off with a flea in his ear if he tried any of his tricks on her." "Was she happy in her place with Miss Wainfleet?"
"She found it a bit dull, sir. And the pay wasn't high. But of course, after she'd been dismissed, the way she was from Ash Manor, it wasn't so easy to get another good place."
"She could have gone away, I suppose."
"To London, do you mean?" or some other part of the country.
Mrs. Church shook her head. She said slowly, Amy didn't want to leave Wychwood.
Not as things were.
How do you mean, as things were? What with Jim and the gentleman at the curio shop?
Luke nodded thoughtfully.
Mrs. Church went on, Miss Wainfleet is a very nice lady, but very particular about brass and silver and everything being dusted and the mattresses turned. Amy wouldn't have put up with the fussing if she hadn't been enjoying herself in other ways.
I can imagine that, said Luke dryly. He turned things over in his mind. He could see no further questions to ask. He was fairly certain that he had extracted all that Mrs. Church knew. He decided on one last tentative attack.
I dare say you can guess the reason of all these questions. The circumstances of Amy's death were rather mysterious. We're not entirely satisfied as to its being an accident. If not, you realize what it must have been.
Mrs. Church said with a certain ghoulish relish,
Foul play.
Quite so. Now, supposing your niece did meet with foul play, who do you think is likely to be responsible for her death?
Mrs. Church wiped her hands on her apron.
There'd be a reward, as likely as not, for setting the police on the right track? She inquired meaningly.
There might be, said Luke.
I wouldn't like to say anything definite.
Mrs. Church passed a hungry tongue over her thin lips.
But the gentleman at the curio shop is a queer one. You'll remember the Castor case, sir, and how they found little bits of the poor girl pinned up all over Castor's seaside bungalow, and how they found 5 or 6 other poor girls he'd served the same way. Maybe this Mr. Ellsworthy's one of that kind.
That's your suggestion, is it?
Well, it might be that way, mightn't it, sir?
Luke admitted that it might. Then he said, Was Ellsworthy away from here on the afternoon of Derby Day? That's a very important point.
Mrs. Church stared.
Derby Day?
Yes, a fortnight ago last Wednesday.
She shook her head.
Really, I couldn't say as to that.
He usually was away on Wednesdays. Went up to town as often as not. It's early closing Wednesday, you see.
Oh, said Luke. Early closing. He took his leave of Mrs. Church, disregarding her insinuations that her time had been valuable, and that she was therefore entitled to monetary compensation. He found himself disliking Mrs. Church intensely. Nevertheless, the conversation he had had with her, though not strikingly illuminative in any way, had provided several suggestive small points. He went over things carefully in his mind. Yes, it still boiled down to those 4 people. Thomas, Abbott, Horton, and Ellsworthy. The attitude of Miss Wainfleet seemed to him to prove that. Her distress and reluctance to mention a name, surely that meant, that must mean, that the person in question was someone of standing in Wychwood, someone whom a chance insinuation might definitely injure. It tallied, too, with Miss Pinkerton's determination to take her suspicions to headquarters. The local police would ridicule her theory. It was not a case of the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. It was not a case of a mere garage mechanic. The person in question was one against whom an accusation of murder was a fantastic and, moreover, a serious matter. There were 4 possible candidates. It was up to him to go carefully once more into the case against each one and make up his own mind. First, to examine the reluctance of Miss Wainfleet. She was a conscientious and scrupulous person. She believed that she knew the man whom Miss Pinkerton had suspected, but it was, she pointed out, only a belief on her part. It was possible that she was mistaken. Who was the person in Miss Wainfleet's mind? Miss Wainfleet was distressed lest an accusation by her might injure an innocent man. Therefore, the object of her suspicions must be a man of high standing, generally liked and respected by the community. Therefore, Luke argued, that automatically barred out Ellsworthy. He was practically a stranger to Wychwood. His local reputation was bad, not good. Luke did not believe that if Ellsworthy was the person in Miss Wainfleet's mind, she would have had any objection to mentioning him. Therefore, as far as Miss Wainfleet was concerned, wash out Ellsworthy. Now, as to the others, Luke believed that he could also eliminate Major Horton. Miss Wainfleet had rebutted with some warmth the suggestion that Horton might have poisoned his wife. If she had suspected him of later crimes,
she would hardly have been so positive about his innocence of the death of Mrs. Horton. That left Dr. Thomas and Mr. Abbott. Both of them fulfilled the necessary requirements. They were men of high professional standing, against whom no word of scandal had ever been uttered. They were, on the whole, both popular and well-liked, and were known as men of integrity and rectitude. Luke proceeded to another aspect of the matter. Could he, himself, eliminate Ellsworthy and Horton? Immediately he shook his head. It was not so simple. Miss Pinkerton had known, really known, who the man was. That was proved in the first case by her own death, and in the second case by the death of Dr. Humbleby. But Miss Pinkerton had never actually mentioned a name to Honoria Wainfleet. Therefore, though Miss Wainfleet thought she knew, she might quite easily be wrong. We often know what other people are thinking, but sometimes we find out that we did not know after all, and have, in fact, made an egregious mistake. Therefore, the four candidates were still in the field. Miss Pinkerton was dead, and could give no further assistance. It was up to Luke to do what he had done before on the day after he came to Witchwood, weigh up the evidence and consider the probabilities. He began with Ellsworthy. On the face of it, Ellsworthy was the likeliest starter. He was abnormal and had possibly a perverted personality. He might quite easily be a lust killer. "Let's take it this way," said Luke to himself. "Suspect everyone in turn. Ellsworthy, for instance. Let's say he's the killer. For the moment, let's take it quite definitely that I know that. Now we'll take the possible victims in chronological order. First, Mrs. Horton. Difficult to see what motive Ellsworthy could have had for doing away with Mrs. Horton. But there was a means. Horton spoke of some quack nostrum that she got from him and took. Some poison like arsenic could have been given that way. The question is, why? Now the others. Amy Gibbs. Why did Ellsworthy kill Amy Gibbs? The obvious reason, she was being a nuisance. Threatened an action for breach of promise, perhaps. Or had she assisted at a midnight orgy? Did she threaten to talk? Lord Whitfield has a good deal of influence in Witchwood, and Lord Whitfield, according to Bridget, is a very moral man. He might have taken up the matter against Ellsworthy, if the latter had been up to anything particularly obscene. So, exit Amy. Not, I think, a sadistic murder. The method employed is against that. Who's next? Carter? Why Carter? Unlikely he would know about midnight orgies, or did Amy tell him? Was the pretty daughter mixed up in it? Did Ellsworthy start making love to her? Must have a look at Lucy Carter. Perhaps he was just abusive to Ellsworthy, and Ellsworthy in his cat-like feline way resented it. If he'd already committed one or two murders, he would be getting sufficiently callous to contemplate a killing for a very slight reason. Now, Tommy Pierce. Why did Ellsworthy kill Tommy Pierce? Easy. Tommy had assisted at a midnight ritual of some kind. Tommy threatened to talk about it. Perhaps Tommy was talking about it. Shut Tommy's mouth. Dr. Humbleby. Why did Ellsworthy kill Dr. Humbleby? That's the easiest of the lot. Humbleby was a doctor, and he'd noticed that Ellsworthy's mental balance was none too good. Probably was getting ready to do something about it. So Humbleby was doomed. There's a stumbling block there in the method. How did Ellsworthy ensure that Humbleby should die of blood poisoning? Or did Humbleby die of something else? Was the poisoned finger a coincidence? Last of all, Miss Pinkerton. Wednesday's early closing. Ellsworthy might have gone up to town that day. Has he a car, I wonder? Never seen him in one, but that proves nothing. He knew she'd suspected him, and he was going to take no chances of Scotland Yard believing her story. Perhaps they already knew something about him then. That's the case against Ellsworthy. Now, what is there for him? Well, one thing, he's certainly not the man Miss Wainfleet thought Miss Pinkerton meant. For another, he doesn't fit quite with my own vague impression. When she was talking, I got a picture of a man, and it wasn't a man like Ellsworthy. The impression she gave me was of a very normal man, outwardly, that is, the kind of man nobody would suspect. Ellsworthy is the kind of man you would suspect. No, I got more the impression of a man like Dr. Thomas. Thomas, now. What about Thomas? I wiped him clean off the list after I'd had a chat with him. Nice, unassuming fellow. But the whole point of this murderer, unless I've got the whole thing wrong, is that he would be a nice, unassuming fellow, the last person you'd think ever would be a murderer. Which, of course, is exactly what one feels about Thomas. Now then, let's go through it all again. Why did Dr. Thomas kill Amy Gibbs? Really, it seems most unlikely that he did, but she did go to see him that day, and he did give her that bottle of cough mixture. Suppose that was really oxalic acid. That would be very simple and clever. Who was called in, I wonder, when she was found poisoned? Humbleby or Thomas? If it was Thomas, he might just come along with an old bottle of hat paint in his pocket, put it down unobtrusively on the table, and take off both bottles to be analyzed as bold as brass. Something like that. It could be done, if you were cool enough. Tommy Pierce. Again, I can't see a likely motive. That's the difficulty with our Dr. Thomas. Motive. There's not even a crazy motive. Same with Carter. Why should Dr. Thomas want to dispose of Carter? One can only assume that Amy, Tommy, and the publican all knew something about Dr. Thomas that was unhealthy to know. Ah. Supposing now that that something was the death of Mrs. Horton. Dr. Thomas attended her, and she died of a rather unexpected relapse. He could have managed that easily enough. And Amy Gibbs, remember, was in the house at the time. She might have seen or heard something. That would account for her. Tommy Pierce, we have it on good authority, was a particularly inquisitive small boy. He may have got wise to something. Can't get Carter in. Amy Gibbs told him something. He may have repeated it in his cups, and Thomas may have decided to silence him too. All this, of course, is pure conjecture. But what else can one do? Now, Humbleby. Ah, at last we come to a perfectly plausible murder. Adequate motive and ideal means. If Dr. Thomas couldn't give his partner blood poisoning, no one could. He could reinfect the wound every time he dressed it. I wish the earlier killings were a little more plausible. Miss Pinkerton. She's more difficult. But there is one definite fact. Dr. Thomas was not in Wychwood for at least a good part of the day. He gave out that he was attending a confinement. That may be. But the fact remains that he was away from Wychwood in a car. Is there anything else? Yes, just one thing. The look he gave me. When I went away from the house the other day. Superior. Condescending. The smile of a man who just led me up the garden path and knew it. Luke sighed, shook his head, and went on with his reasoning. Abbott? He's the right kind of man, too. Normal, well-to-do, respected, last sort of man, etc., etc. He's conceited, too, and confident. Murderers usually are. They've got overweening conceit. Always think they'll get away with it. Amy Gibbs paid him a visit once. Why? What did she want to see him for? To get legal advice? Why? Or was it a personal matter? There's that mention of a letter from a lady that Tommy saw. Was that letter from Amy Gibbs? Or was it a letter written by Mrs. Horton? A letter perhaps that Amy Gibbs had got hold of? What other lady could there be writing to Mr. Abbott on a matter so private that he loses control when the office boy inadvertently sees it? What else can we think of re-Amy Gibbs? The hat paint? Yes, right kind of old-fashioned touch. Men like Abbott are usually well behind the times, where women are concerned. The old-world style of philanderer. Tommy Pierce? Obvious. On account of the letter. Really, it must have been a very damning letter. Carter? Well, there was trouble about Carter's daughter. Abbott wasn't going to have a scandal. A low-down, ruffianly half-wit like Carter dare to threaten him. He, who had got away with two clever killings, away with Mr. Carter. Dark night, and a well-directed push. Really, this killing business is almost too easy. Have I got the Abbott mentality? I think so. Nasty look in an old lady's eye. She's thinking things about him. Then, row with Humbleby. Old Humbleby. Daring to set himself against Abbott, the clever solicitor and murderer. The old fool. He little knows what's in store for him. He's for it, daring to browbeat me. And then, what? Turning to catch Lavinia Pinkerton's eyes, and his own eyes falter, show a consciousness of guilt. He, who was boasting of being unsuspected, has definitely aroused suspicion. Miss Pinkerton knows his secret. She knows what he has done. Yes, but she can't have proof. But suppose she goes about looking for it. Supposing she talks. Suppose—he's quite a shrewd judge of character. He guesses what she will finally do. If she goes with this tale of hers to Scotland Yard, they may believe her. They may start making inquiries. Something pretty desperate has got to be done. Has Abbott got a car, or did he hire one in London? Anyway, he was away from here on Derby Day. Again, Luke paused. He was so entering into the spirit of the thing that he found it hard to make a transition from one suspect to another. He had to wait a minute before he could force himself into the mood where he could visualize Major Horton as a successful murderer. Horton murdered his wife. Let's start with that. He had ample provocation, and he gained considerably by her death. In order to carry it off successfully, he had to make a good show of devotion. He's had to keep that up. Sometimes, shall we say, he overdoes it a bit. Very good. One murder successfully accomplished. Who's the next? Amy Gibbs. Yes, perfectly credible. Amy was in the house. She may have seen something. The Major administering a soothing cup of beef tea or gruel. She mayn't have realized the point of what she saw till some time later. The hat paint trick is the sort of thing that would occur to the Major quite naturally. A very masculine man with little knowledge of women's fripperies. Amy Gibbs, all Serene had accounted for. The drunken carter? Same suggestion as before. Amy told him something. Another straightforward murder. Now, Tommy Pierce. We've got to fall back on his inquisitive nature. I suppose the letter in Abbott's office couldn't have been a complaint from Mrs. Horton that her husband was trying to poison her. That's a wild suggestion, but it might be so. Anyway, the Major comes alive to the fact that Tommy is a menace, so Tommy joins with Amy and Carter, all quite simple, and straightforward, and according to Cocker, easy to kill, my God, yes. But now we come to something rather more difficult. Humbleby. Motive? Very obscure. Humbleby was attending Mrs. Horton originally. Did he get puzzled by the illness, and did Horton influence his wife to change to the younger, more unsuspicious doctor? But if so, what made Humbleby a danger so long after? Difficult, that. The manner of his death, too. A poisoned finger doesn't connect up with the Major. Miss Pinkerton? Well, that's perfectly possible. He has a car. I saw it. And he was away from Wychwood that day, supposedly gone to the Derby. It might be. Yes. Is Horton a cold-blooded killer? Is he? I wish I knew. Luke stared ahead of him. His brow was puckered with thought. It's one of them. I don't think it's Ellsworthy, but it might be. He's the most obvious one. Thomas is wildly unlikely. If it weren't for the manner of Humbleby's death, that blood poisoning definitely points to a medical murderer. It could be Abbott. There's not as much evidence against him as against the others, but I can see him in the part somehow. Yes, he fits. As the others don't, and it could be Horton. Bullied by his wife for years, feeling his insignificance. Yes, it could be. But Miss Wainfleet doesn't think it is, and she's no fool, and she knows the place and the people in it. Which does she suspect? Abbott or Thomas? It must be one of these two. If I tackled her outright, which of them is it? I'd get it out of her then, perhaps. But even then, she might be wrong. There's no way of proving her right. Like Miss Pinkerton proved herself. More evidence, that's what I want. If there were to be one more case, just one more, then I'd know. He stopped himself with a start. My God, he said under his breath. What I'm asking for is another murder. Chapter 15. Improper Conduct of a Chauffeur. In the bar of the Seven Stars, Luke drank his pint and felt somewhat embarrassed. The stare of half a dozen bucolic pairs of eyes followed his least movement, and conversation had come to a standstill upon his entrance. Luke essayed a few comments of general interest, such as the crops, the state of the weather, and football coupons. But to none did he get any response. He was reduced to gallantry. The fine-looking girl behind the counter, with her black hair and red cheeks, he rightly judged to be Miss Lucy Carter. His advances were received in a pleasant spirit. Miss Carter duly giggled and said, "Go on with you, I'm sure. You don't think nothing of the kind. That's telling," and other such rejoinders. But the performance was clearly mechanical. Luke, seeing no advantage to be gained by remaining, finished his beer and departed. He walked along the path to where the river was spanned by a footbridge. He was standing looking at this when a quavering voice behind him said,
That's it, mister. That's where old Harry went over.
Luke turned to see one of his late fellow drinkers, one who had been particularly unresponsive to the topic of crops, weather, and coupons. He was now clearly about to enjoy himself as a guide to the macabre.
Went over into the mud, he did, said the ancient labourer. Right into the mud, and stuck in it, head downwards.
Odd he should have fallen off here, said Luke.
He were drunk, he were,
said the rustic indulgently. Yes, but he must have come this way, drunk many times before.
Most every night, said the other. Always in liquor, Harry were.
Perhaps someone pushed him over, said Luke, making the suggestion in a casual fashion.
They might have, the rustic agreed. But I don't know who'd go for to do that, he added.
He might have made a few enemies. He was fairly abusive when he was drunk, wasn't he?
His language was a treat to hear. Didn't mince his words, Harry didn't. But no one would go for to push a man what's drunk.
Luke did not combat this statement. It was evidently regarded as wildly unsporting for advantage to be taken of a man's state of intoxication. The rustic had sounded quite shocked at the idea.
Well, he said vaguely, it was a sad business. None so sad for his missus, said the old man. Reckon her and Lucy haven't no call to be sad about it.
There may be other people who are glad to have him out of the way. The old man was vague about that.
Maybe, he said. But he didn't mean no harm, Harry didn't.
On this epitaph for the late Mr. Carter, they parted. Luke bent his steps towards the old hall. The library transacted its business in the two front rooms. Luke passed on to the back through a door which was labelled Museum. There he moved from case to case, studying the not very inspiring exhibits. Some Roman pottery and coins, some South Sea curiosities, a Malay headdress, various Indian gods presented by Major Horton, together with a large and malevolent-looking Buddha, and a case of doubtful-looking Egyptian beads. Luke wandered out again into the hall. There was no one about. He went quietly up the stairs. There was a room with magazines and papers there, and a room filled with non-fiction books. Luke went a story higher. Here were rooms filled with what he designated to himself as junk. Stuffed birds, removed from the museum owing to the moth having attacked them. Stacks of torn magazines, and a room whose shelves were covered with out-of-date works of fiction and children's books. Luke approached the window. Here it must have been that Tommy Pierce had sat, possibly whistling and occasionally rubbing a pane of glass vigorously when he heard someone coming. Somebody had come in. Tommy had shown his zeal, sitting half out of the window and polishing with zest, and then that somebody had come up to him, and while talking, had given a sudden sharp push. Luke turned away. He walked down the stairs and stood a minute or two in the hall. Nobody had noticed him come in. Nobody had seen him go upstairs. Anyone might have done it, said Luke. Easiest thing in the world. He heard footsteps coming from the direction of the library proper. Since he was an innocent man with no objection to being seen, he could remain where he was. If he had not wanted to be seen, how easy just to step back inside the door of the museum room. Miss Wainfleet came out from the library, a little pile of books under her arm. She was pulling on her gloves. She looked very happy and busy. When she saw him, her face lit up and she exclaimed, "Oh, Mr. Fitzwilliam, have you been looking at the museum? I'm afraid there isn't very much there, really. Lord Whitfield is talking of getting us some really interesting exhibits."
"Oh, really?"
"Yes, something modern, you know, and up-to-date, like they have at the Science Museum in London. He suggests a model aeroplane and a locomotive and some chemical things, too."
"Oh, that would perhaps brighten things up."
"Yes, I don't think a museum should deal solely with the past, do you?"
"Perhaps not."
"And then some food exhibits, too. Calories and vitamins, all that sort of thing. Lord Whitfield is so keen on the greater fitness campaign."
So he was saying the other night.
"It's the thing at present, isn't it? Lord Whitfield was telling me how he'd been to the Wellerman Institute, and seen such a lot of germs and cultures and bacteria, it quite made me shiver, and he told me all about mosquitoes and sleeping sickness, and something about a liver fluke that I'm afraid was a little too difficult for me."
"It was probably too difficult for Lord Whitfield," said Luke cheerfully. "I'll bet he got it all wrong. You've got a much clearer brain than he has, Miss Wainfleet."
Miss Wainfleet said sedately, "That's very nice of you, Mr. Fitzwilliam, but I'm afraid women are never quite such deep thinkers as men."
Luke repressed a desire to criticize adversely Lord Whitfield's processes of thought. Instead, he said, "I did look into the museum, but afterwards I went up to have a look at the top windows."
"Oh, you mean where Tommy—"
Miss Wainfleet shivered.
"It's really very horrible."
"Yes, it's not a nice thought. I've spent about an hour with Mrs. Church, Amy's aunt. Not a nice woman."
"Not at all."
"I had to take rather a strong line with her," said Luke. "I fancy she thinks I'm a kind of super policeman." He stopped as he noted a sudden change of expression on Miss Wainfleet's face.
"Oh, Mr. Fitzwilliam, do you think that was wise?"
Luke said, "I don't know, really. I think it was inevitable. The book story was wearing thin. I can't get much further on that. I had to ask the kind of questions that were directly to the point."
Miss Wainfleet shook her head, the troubled expression still on her face. "In a place like this, you see, everything gets round so fast."
"Oh, you mean that everybody will say, 'There goes the tech,' as I walk down the street? I don't think that really matters now. In fact, I may get more that way."
"I wasn't thinking of that."
Miss Wainfleet sounded a little breathless.
"What I meant was that he'll know. He'll realize that you're on his track."
Luke said slowly, "I suppose he will." Miss Wainfleet said,
"But don't you see? That's horribly dangerous. Horribly."
"You mean," Luke grasped her point at last, "you mean that the killer would have a crack at me?"
"Yes."
"Funny," said Luke. "I never thought of that. I believe you're right, though. Well, that might be the best thing that could happen."
Miss Wainfleet said earnestly, "I don't think you realize that he's a very clever man. He's cautious, too, and remember, he's got a great deal of experience, perhaps more than we know."
"Yes," said Luke thoughtfully. "That's probably true."
Miss Wainfleet exclaimed, "Oh, I don't like it. Really, I feel quite alarmed."
Luke said gently, "You needn't worry. I shall be very much on my guard, I can assure you. You see, I've narrowed the possibilities down pretty closely. I've an idea, at any rate, who the killer might be."
She looked up sharply.
Luke came a step nearer. He lowered his voice to a whisper. "Miss Wainfleet, if I were to ask you which of two men you considered the most likely, Dr. Thomas or Mr. Abbott, what would you say?"
"Oh,"
said Miss Wainfleet. A hand flew to her breast. She stepped back. Her eyes met Luke's in an expression that puzzled him. They showed impatience and something closely allied to it that he could not quite place. She said,
"I can't say anything."
She turned away abruptly with a curious sound, half a sigh, half a sob. Luke resigned himself. "Are you going home?" he asked.
"No, I was going to take these books to Mrs. Humbleby.
That lies on your way back to the manor. We might go part of the way together."
"That will be very nice," said Luke.
They went down the steps, turned to the left, skirting the village green. Luke looked back at the stately lines of the house they had left.
"It must have been a lovely house in your father's day," he said.
Miss Wainfleet sighed.
"Yes, we were all very happy there. I'm so thankful it hasn't been pulled down. So many of the old houses are going."
"I know. It's sad.
And really, the new ones aren't nearly as well built."
"I doubt if they will stand the test of time as well."
"But of course," said Miss Wainfleet, "the new ones are convenient. So labor-saving, and not such big, drafty passages to scrub."
Luke assented. When they arrived at the gate of Dr. Humbleby's house, Miss Wainfleet hesitated and said,
"Such a beautiful evening. I think if you don't mind, I will come a little farther. I'm enjoying the air."
Somewhat surprised, Luke expressed pleasure politely. It was hardly what he would have described as a beautiful evening. There was a strong wind blowing, turning back the leaves viciously on the trees. A storm, he thought, might come at any minute. Miss Wainfleet, however, clutching her hat with one hand, walked by his side with every appearance of enjoyment, talking as she went in little gasps. It was a somewhat lonely lane that they were taking, since from Dr. Humbleby's house the shortest way to Ash Manor was not by the main road, but by a side lane which led to one of the back gates of the manor house. This gate was not of the same ornate ironwork, but had two handsome gate pillars, surmounted by two vast pink pineapples.
Why pineapples, Luke had been unable to discover, but he gathered that to Lord Whitfield, pineapples spelt distinction and good taste. As they approached the gate, the sound of voices raised in anger came to them. A moment later, they came inside of Lord Whitfield, confronting a young man in a chauffeur's uniform.
"You're fired!" Lord Whitfield was shouting. "Do you hear? You're fired!"
"If you'd overlook it, my lord, just this once..."
"No, I won't overlook it. Taking my car out, my car, and what's more, you've been drinking. Yes, you have. Don't deny it. I've made it clear. There are three things I won't have on my estate. One's drunkenness, another's immorality, and the other's impertinence."
Though the man was not actually drunk, he had had enough to loosen his tongue. His manner changed.
"You won't have this, and you won't have that, you old bastard. Your estate. Think we don't all know your father kept a boot shop down here?
Makes us laugh ourselves sick, it does, seeing you strutting about as cock of the walk. Who are you, I'd like to know? You're no better than I am. That's what you are."
Lord Whitfield turned purple.
"How dare you speak to me like that? How dare you?"
The young man took a threatening step forward.
"If you wasn't such a miserable pot-bellied little swine, I'd give you a sock on the jaw. Yes, I would."
Lord Whitfield hastily retreated a step, tripped over a root, and went down into a sitting position. Luke had come up.
"Get out of here,"
he said roughly to the chauffeur. The latter regained sanity. He looked frightened.
"Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I don't know what came over me, I'm sure."
"Couple of glasses too much, I should say," said Luke.
He assisted Lord Whitfield to his feet.
I beg your pardon, my lord," stammered the man.
"You'll be sorry for this, Rivers," said Lord Whitfield.
His voice trembled with intense feeling. The man hesitated a minute, then shambled away slowly. Lord Whitfield exploded.
"Colossal impertinence! To me! Speaking to me like that! Something very serious will happen to that man. No respect. No proper sense of his station in life. When I think of what I do for these people. Good wages. Every comfort. A pension when they retire. The ingratitude. The base ingratitude."
He choked with excitement. Then perceived Miss Wainfleet, who was standing silently by.
"Oh, is that you, Honoria? I'm deeply distressed that you should have witnessed such a disgraceful scene. That man's language—"
"I'm afraid he wasn't quite himself, Lord Whitfield," said Miss Wainfleet primly.
"He was drunk. That's what he was, drunk."
"Just a bit lit up," said Luke.
"Do you know what he did?"
Lord Whitfield looked from one to the other of them.
"Took out my car. My car!
Thought I shouldn't be back so soon. Bridget drove me over to Lyne in the two-seater, and this fellow had the impertinence to take a girl, Lucy Carter, I believe, out in my car!"
Miss Wainfleet said gently,
"A most improper thing to do."
Lord Whitfield seemed a little comforted.
"Yes, wasn't it?
But I'm sure he'll regret it."
"I shall see that he does."
"You've dismissed him,"
Miss Wainfleet pointed out. Lord Whitfield shook his head.
"He'll come to a bad end, that fellow."
He threw back his shoulders.
"Come up to the house, Honoria. Have a glass of sherry."
Thank you, Lord Whitfield, but I must go to Mrs. Humbleby with these books. Good night, Mr. Fitzwilliam. You'll be quite all right now."
She gave him a smiling nod and walked briskly away. It was so much the attitude of a nurse who delivers a child at a party that Luke caught his breath. A sudden idea struck him. Was it possible that Miss Wainfleet had accompanied him solely in order to protect him? The idea seemed ludicrous, but... Lord Whitfield's voice interrupted his meditations.
"Very capable woman, Honoria Wainfleet."
"Very, I should think." Lord Whitfield began to walk towards the house. He moved rather stiffly, and his hand went to his posterior and rubbed it gingerly. Suddenly he chuckled.
"I was engaged to Honoria once, years ago. She was a nice-looking girl, not so skinny as she is today. Seems funny to think of it now. Her people were the nobs of this place."
"Yes?" Lord Whitfield ruminated.
"Old Colonel Wainfleet bossed the show. One had to come out and touch one's cap pretty sharp. One of the old school he was, and proud as Lucifer."
He chuckled again.
"The fat was in the fire all right when Honoria announced she was going to marry me. Called herself a radical, she did. Very earnest. Was all for abolishing class distinctions. She was a serious kind of girl."
"So her family broke up the romance."
Lord Whitfield rubbed his nose.
Well, not exactly. Matter of fact, we had a bit of a row over something. Blinking bird she had. One of those beastly twittering canaries. Always hated them. Bad business. Wrung its neck. Well, no good dwelling on that now. Let's forget it. He shook his shoulders like a man who throws off an unpleasant memory. Then he said, rather jerkily, "Don't think she's ever forgiven me. Well, perhaps it's only natural." "Oh, I think she's forgiven you all right," said Luke. Lord Whitfield brightened up. "Do you?" "I'm glad of that. You know, I respect Honoria. Capable woman, and a lady. That still counts, even in these days. She runs that library business very well." He looked up, and his voice changed. "Hello," he said. "Here comes Bridget." Chapter 16. The Pineapple. Luke felt a tightening of his muscles as Bridget approached. He had had no word alone with her since the day of the tennis party. By mutual consent, they had avoided each other. He stole a glance at her now. She looked provokingly calm, cool, and indifferent. She said lightly, "I was beginning to wonder what on earth had become of you, Warden." Lord Whitfield grunted. "Had a bit of a dust-up. That fellow Rivers had the impertinence to take the rolls out this afternoon." "Less majesty," said Bridget. "It's no good making a joke of it, Bridget. The thing's serious. He took a girl out." "I don't suppose it would have given him any pleasure to go solemnly for a drive by himself." Lord Whitfield drew himself up. "On my estate, I'll have decent moral behaviour." "It isn't actually immoral to take a girl joyriding."
"It is when it's my car."
"That, of course, is worse than immorality. Practically amounts to blasphemy. But you can't cut out the sex stuff altogether, Gordon. The moon is at the full, and it's actually Midsummer Eve."
"Is it, by Jove?" said Luke.
Bridget threw him a glance. "That seems to interest you?"
"It does."
Bridget turned back to Lord Whitfield. "Three extraordinary people have arrived at the Bells and Motley. Item one, a man with shorts, spectacles, and a lovely plum-coloured silk shirt. Item two, a female with no eyebrows, dressed in a peplum, a pound of assorted sham Egyptian beads, and sandals. Item three, a fat man in a lavender suit and correspondent shoes. I suspect them of being friends of our Mr. Ellsworthy. Says the gossip writer, someone has whispered that there will be gay doings in the Witch's Meadow tonight." Lord Whitfield turned purple and said,
"I won't have it!"
"You can't help it, darling. The Witch's Meadow is public property."
"I won't have this irreligious mumbo-jumbo going on down here. I'll expose it in scandals."
He paused, then said, "Remind me to make a note about that and get Sidley onto it. I must go up to town tomorrow." "Lord Whitfield's campaign against witchcraft," said Bridget flippantly. "Medieval superstitions still rife in quiet country village." Lord Whitfield stared at her with a puzzled frown. Then he turned and went into the house. Luke said pleasantly, "You must do your stuff better than that, Bridget."
"What do you mean?"
"It would be a pity if you lost your job. That 100,000 isn't yours yet, nor are the diamonds and pearls. I should wait until after the marriage ceremony to exercise your sarcastic gifts if I were you." A glance met his coolly.
"You're so thoughtful, dear Luke. It's kind of you to take my future so much to heart."
"Kindness and consideration have always been my strong points. I hadn't noticed it."
"No?
You surprise me." Bridget twitched the leaf off a creeper. She said, "What have you been doing today?"
"Oh, the usual spot of sleuthing." "Any results?"
"Yes and no, as the politicians say."
"By the way, have you got any tools in the house?"
"I expect so. What kind of tools?"
"Oh, any handy little gadgets. Perhaps I could inspect some."
10 minutes later, Luke had made a selection from a cupboard shelf. "That little lot will do nicely," he said, slapping the pocket in which he had stowed them away.
"Are you thinking of doing a spot of forcing and entering?"
"Maybe." "Well, you're very uncommunicative on the subject." "Well, after all, the situation bristles with difficulties. I'm in the hell of a position. After our little knock-up on Saturday, I suppose I ought to clear out of here."
"To behave as a perfect gentleman? You should."
"But since I'm convinced that I'm pretty hot on the trail of a homicidal maniac, I'm more or less forced to remain. If you could think of any convincing reason for me to leave here and take up my quarters at the Bells and Motley, for goodness sake, trot it out." Bridget shook her head.
"That's not feasible.
you being a cousin and all that. Besides, the inn is full of Mr. Ellsworthy's friends. They only run to 3 guest rooms.
So, I'm forced to remain, painful as it must be for you. Bridget smiled sweetly at him.
Not at all. I can always do with a few scalps to dangle.
That, said Luke appreciatively, was a particularly dirty crack.
What I admire about you, Bridget, is that you have practically no instincts of kindness.
Well, well, the rejected lover will now go and change for dinner. The evening passed uneventfully. Luke won Lord Whitfield's approval even more deeply than before by the apparent absorbed interest with which he listened to the other's nightly discourse. When they came into the drawing room, Bridget said,
"You men have been a long time?"
Luke replied, "Lord Whitfield was being so interesting that the time passed like a flash. He was telling me how he founded his first newspaper."
Mrs. Anstruther said,
"Those new little fruiting trees in pots are perfectly marvellous, I believe. You ought to try them along the terrace garden."
The conversation then proceeded on normal lines. Luke retired early. He did not, however, go to bed. He had other plans. It was just striking 12 when he descended the stairs noiselessly in tennis shoes, passed through the library, and let himself out by a window. The wind was still blowing in violent gusts, interspersed with brief lulls. Clouds scudded across the sky, obliterating the moon so that darkness alternated with bright moonlight. Luke made his way by a circuitous route to Mr. Ellsworthy's establishment. He saw his way clear to doing a little investigation. He was fairly certain that Ellsworthy and his friends would be out together on this particular date. Midsummer Eve, Luke thought, was sure to be marked by some ceremony or other. Whilst this was in progress, it would be a good opportunity to search Mr. Ellsworthy's house. He climbed a couple of walls, got round the back of the house, took the assorted tools from his pocket, and selected a likely implement. He found a scullery window, amenable to his efforts. A few minutes later, he had slipped back the catch, raised the sash, and hoisted himself over. He had a torch in his pocket. He used it sparingly, a brief flash to show him his way, and to avoid running into things. In a quarter of an hour, he had satisfied himself that the house was empty. The owner was out, and abroad, on his own affairs. Luke smiled with satisfaction and settled down to his task. He made a minute and thorough search of every available nook and corner. In a locked drawer, below 2 or 3 innocuous watercolour sketches, he came upon some artistic efforts which caused him to lift his eyebrows and whistle. Mr. Ellsworthy's correspondence was unilluminating, but some of his books, those tucked away at the back of a cupboard, repaid attention. Besides these, Luke accumulated 3 meagre but suggestive scraps of information. The first was a pencil scrawl in a little notebook. "Settle with Tommy Pierce," the date being a couple of days before the boy's death. The second was a crayon sketch of Amy Gibbs with a furious red cross right across her face. The third was a bottle of cough mixture. None of these things were in any way conclusive, but taken together, they might be considered as encouraging. Luke was just restoring some final order, replacing things in their place, when he suddenly stiffened and switched off his torch. He had heard the key inserted in the lock of a side door. He stepped across to the door of the room he was in and applied an eye to the crack. He hoped Ellsworthy, if it was he, would go straight upstairs. The side door opened, and Ellsworthy stepped in, switching on a hall light as he did so. As he passed along the hall, Luke saw his face and caught his breath. It was unrecognizable. There was foam on the lips. The eyes were alight with a strange, mad exultation as he pranced along the hall in little dancing steps. But what caused Luke to catch his breath was the sight of Ellsworthy's hands. They were stained a deep, brownish red, the color of dried blood. He disappeared up the stairs. A moment later, the light in the hall was extinguished. Luke waited a little longer, then very cautiously, he crept out of the hall, made his way to the scullery, and left by the window. He looked up at the house, but it was dark and silent. He drew a deep breath. "My God," he said. "The fellow's mad, all right. I wonder what he's up to. I'll swear that was blood on his hands." He made a detour around the village and returned to Ash Manor by a roundabout route. It was as he was turning into the side lane
that a sudden rustle of leaves made him swing round.
"Who's there?"
A tall figure wrapped in a dark cloak came out from the shadow of a tree. It looked so eerie that Luke felt his heart miss a beat. Then he recognized the long, pale face under the hood.
"Bridget! How you startled me!"
she said sharply.
"Where have you been? I saw you go out.
And you followed me?
No,
you'd gone too far. I've been waiting till you came back."
"Well, that was a damn silly thing to do,"
Luke grumbled. She repeated her question impatiently.
"Where have you been?"
Luke said gaily,
"Raiding our Mr. Ellsworthy."
Bridget caught her breath.
"Did you find anything?"
"I don't know. I know a bit more about the swine, his pornographical tastes and all that, and there are three things that might be suggestive." She listened attentively as he recounted the result of his search. "It's very slight evidence, though," he ended. "But Bridget, just as I was leaving, Ellsworthy came back, and I tell you this, the man's as mad as a hatter."
"You really think so?"
"I saw his face. It was unspeakable. God knows what he'd been up to. He was in a delirium of mad excitement, and his hands were stained, I'll swear, with blood." Bridget shivered.
"Horrible,"
she murmured. Luke said irritably,
"You shouldn't have come out by yourself, Bridget. It was absolute madness. Somebody might have knocked you on the head."
She laughed shakily. "The same applies to you, my dear. I can look after myself. I'm pretty good at taking care of myself, too. Hard-boiled, I should think you'd call me." A sharp gust of wind came. Luke said suddenly, "Take off that hood thing."
"Why?"
With an unexpected movement, he snatched at her cloak and whipped it away. The wind caught her hair and blew it straight up from her head. She stared at him, her breath coming fast. Luke said, "You certainly are incomplete without a broomstick, Bridget. That's how I saw you first." He stared a minute longer and said, "You're a cruel devil." With a sharp, impatient sigh, he tossed the cloak back to her. "There, put it on. Let's go home."
"Wait."
"Why?" She came up to him. She spoke in a low, rather breathless voice.
"Because I've got something to say to you. That's partly why I waited for you here, outside the manor. I want to say it to you now, before we go inside, into Gordon's property."
"Well?" She gave a short, rather bitter laugh.
"It's quite simple.
You win, Luke. That's all." He said sharply,
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that I've given up the idea of being Lady Whitfield." He took a step nearer. "Is that true?" he demanded.
"Yes, Luke."
"You'll marry me?"
"Yes."
"Why, I wonder?"
"I don't know. You say such beastly things to me, and I seem to like it."
He took her in his arms and kissed her. He said,
"It's a mad world."
"Are you happy, Luke?"
"Not particularly."
"Do you think you'll ever be happy with me?"
"I don't know. I'll risk it."
"Yes, that's what I feel." He slipped his arm through hers. "We're rather queer about all this, my sweet. Come along. Perhaps we shall be more normal in the morning."
"Yes, it's rather frightening the way things happen to one."
She looked down and tugged him to a standstill.
"Luke, Luke, what's that?"
The moon had come out from the clouds. Luke looked down to where Bridget's shoe trembled by a huddled mass. With a startled exclamation, he dragged his arm free and knelt down. He looked from the shapeless heap to the gatepost above. The pineapple was gone. He stood up at last. Bridget was standing, her hands pressed together on her mouth. He said,
"It's the chauffeur, Rivers. He's dead."
"That beastly stone thing. It's been loose for some time. I suppose it blew down on him." Luke shook his head. "The wind wouldn't do a thing like that."
"Oh, that's what it's meant to look like. That's what it's meant to be, another accident. But it's a fake. It's the killer again."
"No. No, Luke, I tell you it is. Do you know what I've felt on the back of his head? In with the stickiness and mess, grains of sand. There's no sand about here. I tell you, Bridget, somebody stood here and slugged him as he came through the gate back to his cottage, then laid him down and rolled that pineapple thing down on top of him."
Bridget said faintly, "Luke, there's blood on your hands.
Luke said grimly. There was blood on someone else's hands. Do you know what I was thinking this afternoon? That if there were to be one more crime, we'd surely know. And we do know. Ellsworthy. He was out tonight, and he came in with blood on his hands, capering and prancing and mad, drunk, with the homicidal maniac's expression. Looking down, Bridget shivered and said in a low voice,
"Poor Rivers,"
Luke said pityingly. "Yes, poor fellow. It's damnable bad luck. But this will be the last, Bridget. Now we know we'll get him." He saw her sway, and in two steps he had caught her in his arms. She said in a small, childlike voice,
"Luke, I'm frightened."
He said, "It's all over, darling. It's all over." She murmured,
"Be kind to me, please. I've been hurt so much."
He said, "We've hurt each other. We won't do that anymore." Chapter 17. Lord Whitfield talks. Dr. Thomas stared across his consulting room desk at Luke.
"Remarkable," he said. "Remarkable. You are really serious, Mr. Fitzwilliam?"
"Absolutely. I'm convinced that Ellsworthy is a dangerous maniac.
I've not paid special attention to the man.
I should say, though, that he is possibly an abnormal type." "I'd go a good deal further than that," said Luke grimly.
"You seriously believe that this man Rivers was murdered?"
"I do. You noticed the grains of sand in the wound?" Dr. Thomas nodded.
"I looked out for them after your statement. I'm bound to say that you were correct."
"That makes it clear, does it not, that the accident was faked and the man was killed by a blow from a sandbag, or at any rate was stunned by one?"
"Not necessarily."
"What do you mean?" Dr. Thomas leaned back and joined his fingertips together.
"Supposing that this man Rivers had been lying out in a sand pit during the day. There are several about in this part of the world. That might account for grains of sand in the hair. And I tell you he was murdered."
"You may tell me so," said Dr. Thomas dryly, "but that doesn't make it a fact." Luke controlled his exasperation.
"I suppose you don't believe a word of what I'm telling you."
Dr. Thomas smiled, a kindly, superior smile.
"You must admit, Mr. Fitzwilliam, that it's rather a wild story. You assert that this man Ellsworthy has killed a servant girl, a small boy, a drunken publican, my own partner, and finally this man Rivers."
"You don't believe it?" Dr. Thomas shrugged his shoulders.
"I have some knowledge of Humbleby's case. It seems to me quite out of the question that Ellsworthy could have caused his death. And I really cannot see that you have any evidence at all that he did so."
"I don't know how he managed it," confessed Luke, "but it all hangs together with Miss Pinkerton's story.
But there again, you assert that Ellsworthy followed her up to London and ran her down in a car. Again, you haven't a shadow of proof that that happened."
"It's all, well, romancing," Luke said sharply. "Now that I know where I am, it will be my business to get proofs. I'm going up to London tomorrow to see an old pal of mine. I saw in the paper 2 days ago that he'd been made Assistant Commissioner of Police. He knows me, and he'll listen to what I have to say. One thing I'm sure of, he'll order a thorough investigation of the whole business."
Dr. Thomas stroked his chin thoughtfully. "Well, no doubt that should be very satisfactory.
If it turns out that you're mistaken..."
Luke interrupted him. "You definitely don't believe a word of all this."
"In wholesale murder?" Dr. Thomas raised his eyebrows.
"Quite frankly, Mr. Fitzwilliam, I don't. The thing is too fantastic."
"Fantastic, perhaps, but it hangs together. You've got to admit it hangs together. Once you accept Miss Pinkerton's story as true..."
Dr. Thomas was shaking his head. A slight smile came to his lips.
"If you knew some of these old maids as well as I do," he murmured.
Luke rose, trying to control his annoyance.
"At any rate, you're well named," he said. "A doubting Thomas, if ever there was one."
Thomas replied good-humouredly, "Give me a few proofs, my dear fellow. That's all I ask. Not just a long, melodramatic rigmarole based on what an old lady fancied she saw. What old ladies fancy they see is very often right. My Aunt Mildred was positively uncanny. Have you got any aunts yourself, Thomas?"
"Well, no. A mistake," said Luke. "Every man should have aunts. They illustrate the triumph of guesswork over logic. It is reserved for aunts to know that Mr. A is a rogue because he looks like a dishonest butler they once had.
Other people say, reasonably enough, that a respectable man like Mr. A couldn't be a crook. The old ladies are right every time.
Dr. Thomas smiled, his superior smile again. Luke said, his exasperation mounting once more, "Don't you realize that I'm a policeman myself? I'm not the complete amateur." Dr. Thomas smiled and murmured, "In the Mayang Straits, crime is crime, even in the Mayang Straits."
"Of course, of course."
Luke left Dr. Thomas's surgery in a state of suppressed irritation. He joined Bridget, who said, "Well, how did you get on?"
"He didn't believe me," said Luke, "which, when you come to think of it, is hardly surprising. It's a wild story with no proofs. Dr. Thomas is emphatically not the sort of man who believes 6 impossible things before breakfast."
"Will anybody believe you?"
"Probably not. But when I get hold of old Billy Burns tomorrow, the wheels will start turning. They'll check up on our long-haired friend Ellsworthy, and in the end they're bound to get somewhere."
Bridget said thoughtfully,
"We're coming out into the open very much, aren't we?"
"We've got to. We simply can't afford any more murders."
Bridget shivered.
"For God's sake, be careful, Luke."
"Oh, I'm being careful, all right. Don't walk near gates with pineapples on them. Avoid the lonely wood at nightfall. Watch out for your food and drink. I know all the ropes."
"It's horrible feeling you're a marked man."
"So long as you're not a marked woman, my sweet."
"Perhaps I am."
"I don't think so. But I don't intend to take risks. I'm watching over you like an old-fashioned guardian angel."
"Is it any good saying anything to the police here?"
Luke considered.
"No, I don't think it is. Better go straight to Scotland Yard."
Bridget murmured,
"That's what Miss Pinkerton thought."
"Yes, but I shall be watching out for trouble."
Bridget said, "I know what I'm going to do tomorrow. I shall march Gordon down to that brute's shop and make him buy things, thereby ensuring that our Mr. Ellsworthy is not lying in ambush for me on the steps of Whitehall."
"That's the idea."
Luke said with some slight embarrassment, "About Whitfield."
Bridget said quickly, "Let's leave it till you come back tomorrow. Then we'll have it out."
"Will he be very cut up, do you think?"
"Well," Bridget considered the question, "he'll be annoyed."
"Annoyed? Ye gods, isn't that putting it a bit mildly?"
"No, because you see, Gordon doesn't like being annoyed. It upsets him."
Luke said soberly,
"I feel rather uncomfortable about it all."
That feeling was uppermost in his mind when he prepared that evening to listen for the 20th time to Lord Whitfield on the subject of Lord Whitfield. It was, he admitted, a cad's trick to stay in a man's house and steal his fiancée. He still felt, however, that a pot-bellied, pompous, strutting little nincompoop like Lord Whitfield ought never to have aspired to Bridget at all. But his conscience so far chastened him that he listened with an extra dose of fervent attention, and in consequence made a thoroughly favourable impression on his host. Lord Whitfield was in high good humour this evening. The death of his erstwhile chauffeur seemed to have exhilarated rather than depressed him.
"Told you that fellow would come to a bad end," he crowed, holding up a glass of port to the light and squinting through it. "Didn't I tell you so yesterday evening?"
"You did indeed, sir.
And you see, I was right. It's amazing how often I'm right."
"That must be splendid for you," said Luke.
"I've had a wonderful life. Yes, a wonderful life. My path's been smooth, clear before me. I've always had great faith and trust in Providence. That's the secret, Fitzwilliam. That's the secret. Yes? I'm a religious man. I believe in good and evil and eternal justice. There is such a thing as divine justice, Fitzwilliam. No doubt of it."
"I believe in justice too," said Luke.
Lord Whitfield, as usual, was not interested in the beliefs of other people.
"Do right by your Creator, and your Creator will do right by you. I've always been an upright man. I've subscribed to charity, and I've made my money honestly. I'm not beholden to any man. I stand alone. You remember in the Bible how the patriarchs became prosperous, herds and flocks were added to them, and their enemies were smitten down?"
Luke stifled a yawn and said,
"Quite, quite."
"It's remarkable, absolutely remarkable," said Lord Whitfield, "the way that a righteous man's enemies are struck down. Look at yesterday. That fellow abuses me. He even goes so far as to try to raise his hand against me. And what happens? Where is he today?"
He paused rhetorically, and then answered himself in an impressive voice,
"Dead! Struck down by divine wrath!"
Opening his eyes a little, Luke said,
Rather an excessive punishment, perhaps, for a few hasty words uttered after a glass too much? Lord Whitfield shook his head.
It's always like that. Retribution comes swiftly and terribly, and there's good, authentic authority for it. Remember the children that mocked Elisha? How the bears came out and devoured them? That's the way things happen, Fitzwilliam.
I always thought that was rather unnecessarily vindictive.
No, no. You're looking at it the wrong way. Elisha was a great and holy man. No one could be suffered to mock at him and live. I understand that because of my own case.
Luke looked puzzled. Lord Whitfield lowered his voice. I could hardly believe it at first, but it happened every time. My enemies and detractors were cast down and exterminated.
Exterminated?
Lord Whitfield nodded gently and sipped his port.
Time after time.
One case quite like Elisha, a little boy. I came upon him in the gardens here. He was employed by me then. Do you know what he was doing? He was giving an imitation of me.
Of me? Mocking me? Strutting up and down with an audience to watch him, making fun of me on my own ground. Do you know what happened to him? Not 10 days later, he fell out of an upper window and was killed. Then there was that ruffian Carter, a drunkard and a man of evil tongue. He came here and abused me. What happened to him? A week later, he was dead, drowned in the mud. There had been a servant girl, too. She lifted her voice and called me names. Her punishment soon came. She drank poison by mistake. I could tell you heaps more. Humbleby dared to oppose me over the water scheme. He died of blood poisoning. Oh, it's been going on for years. Mrs. Horton, for instance, was abominably rude to me, and it wasn't long before she passed away. He paused, and leaning forward, passed the port decanter round to Luke.
Yes, he said. They all died.
Amazing, isn't it?
Luke stared at him. A monstrous, an incredible suspicion leapt into his mind. With new eyes, he stared at the small, fat man who sat at the head of the table, who was gently nodding his head, and whose light, protuberant eyes met Luke's with a smiling insouciance. A rush of disconnected memories flashed rapidly through Luke's brain. Major Horton saying, Lord Whitfield was very kind, sent down grapes and peaches from his hothouse. It was Lord Whitfield who so graciously allowed Tommy Pierce to be employed on window cleaning at the library. Lord Whitfield, holding forth on his visit to the Wellam and Kreutz Institute with its serums and germ cultures just a short time before Dr. Humbleby's death. Everything pointing plainly in one direction. And he, fool that he had been, never even suspecting. Lord Whitfield was still smiling. A quiet, happy smile, he nodded his head gently at Luke.
They all die, said Lord Whitfield.
Chapter 18. Conference in London. Sir William Ossington, known to the cronies of earlier days as Billy Bones, stared incredulously at his friend.
Didn't you have enough crime out in Mayang? He asked plaintively. Have you got to come home and do our work for us here?
Crime in Mayang isn't on a wholesale basis, said Luke. What I'm up against now is a man who's done a round half-dozen murders at least, and got away with it without a breath of suspicion. Sir William sighed.
It does happen. What's his speciality? Wives?
No, he's not that kind. He doesn't actually think he's God yet, but he soon will.
Mad?
Oh, unquestionably, I should say.
Ah, but he probably isn't legally mad. There's a difference, you know.
I should say he knows the nature and consequence of his acts, said Luke.
Exactly, said Billy Bones.
Well, don't let's quibble about legal technicalities. We're not nearly at that stage yet. Perhaps we never shall be. What I want from you, old boy, is a few facts. There was a street accident, took place on Derby Day between 5 and 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Old lady ran over in Whitehall, and the car didn't stop. Her name was Lavinia Pinkerton. I want you to dig up all the facts you can about that.
Sir William sighed. I can soon get hold of that for you. 20 minutes ought to do it.
He was as good as his word. In less than that time, Luke was talking to the police officer in charge of the matter.
Yes, sir. I remember the details. I've got most of them written down here.
He indicated the sheet that Luke was studying.
An inquest was held. Mr. Satcher Varel was the coroner. Censure of the driver of the car.
Did you ever get him?
No, sir.
What make of car was it?
It seems pretty certain that it was a Rolls, a big car driven by a chauffeur. All witnesses unanimous on that point. Most people know a Rolls by sight.
You didn't get the number?
No, unfortunately, nobody thought to look at it. There was a note of a number, FZX4498, but it was the wrong number. A woman spotted it and mentioned it to another woman who gave it to me. I don't know whether the second woman got it wrong, but anyway, it was no good.
Luke asked sharply, "How did you know it was no good?"
The young officer smiled. FZX4498 is the number of Lord Whitfield's car. That car was standing outside Boomington House at the time in question, and the chauffeur was having tea. He had a perfect alibi. No question of his being concerned, and the car never left the building till 6:30 when his lordship came out.
I see, said Luke.
It's always the way, sir. The man sighed. Half the witnesses have disappeared before a constable can get there and take down particulars.
Sir William nodded.
We assumed it was probably a number not unlike FZX4498, a number beginning probably with 2 4s. We did our best, but could not trace any car. We investigated several likely numbers, but they could all give satisfactory accounts of themselves.
Sir William looked at Luke questioningly.
Luke shook his head. Sir William said, "Thanks, Bonner, that'll do."
When the man had gone out, Billy Bones looked inquiringly at his friend.
"What's it all about, Fitz?"
Luke sighed.
"It all tallies. Lavinia Pinkerton was coming up to blow the gaff, to tell the clever people at Scotland Yard all about the wicked murderer. I don't know whether you'd have listened to her, probably not."
"Oh, we might," said Sir William.
"Things do come through to us that way, just hearsay and gossip. We don't neglect that sort of thing, I assure you."
"Oh, that's what the murderer thought. He wasn't going to risk it. He eliminated Lavinia Pinkerton, and although one woman was sharp enough to spot his number, no one believed her."
Billy Bones sprang upright in his chair. "You don't mean—"
"Yes, I do. I'll bet you anything you like it was Whitfield who ran her down. I don't know how he managed it. The chauffeur was away at tea. Somehow or other, I suppose, he sneaked away and put on a chauffeur's coat and cap. But he did it, Billy."
"Impossible. Not at all. Lord Whitfield has committed at least 7 murders to my certain knowledge, and probably a lot more."
"Impossible," said Sir William again. "My dear fellow, he practically boasted to me of it last night."
"Well, he's mad, then."
"He's mad, all right, but he's a cunning devil. You'll have to go warily. Don't let him know we suspect him."
Billy Bones murmured, "Incredible." Luke said, "But true."
He laid a hand on his friend's shoulder. "Look here, Billy, old son. We must get right down to this. Here are the facts." The two men talked long and earnestly. On the following day, Luke returned to Wychwood. He drove down early in the morning. He could have returned the night before, but he felt a marked distaste for sleeping under Lord Whitfield's roof or accepting his hospitality under the circumstances. On his way through Wychwood, he drew up his car at Miss Wainfleet's house. The maid who opened the door stared at him in astonishment, but showed him into the little dining room where Miss Wainfleet was sitting at breakfast. She rose to receive him in some surprise. He did not waste time. "I must apologize for breaking in on you at this hour." He looked round. The maid had left the room, shutting the door. "I'm going to ask you a question, Miss Wainfleet. It's rather a personal one, but I think you will forgive me for asking it."
"Please, ask me anything you like. I'm quite sure your reason for doing so will be a good one." "Thank you."
He paused.
"I want to know exactly why you broke off your engagement to Lord Whitfield all those years ago."
She had not expected that.
The colour rose in her cheeks, and one hand went to her breast. "Has he told you anything?"
Luke replied,
"He told me there was something about a bird whose neck was wrung."
"He said that?"
Her voice was wondering.
"He admitted it?
That's extraordinary. Will you tell me, please?"
"Yes, I will tell you. But I beg that you will never speak of the matter to him, but to Gordon. It is all past, all over and finished with. I don't want it raked up."
She looked at him appealingly.
Luke nodded.
"It's only for my personal satisfaction," he said. "I shall not repeat what you tell me."
"Thank you."
She had recovered her composure. Her voice was quite steady as she went on.
"It was like this. I had a little canary. I was very fond of it. And, perhaps, rather silly about it. Girls were then. They were rather, well,
coy about their pets. It must have been irritating to a man, I do realize that.
Yes, said Luke, as she paused.
Gordon was jealous of the bird. He said one day, quite ill-temperedly, I believe you prefer that bird to me. And I, in the rather silly way girls went on in those days, laughed and held it up on my finger, saying something like, Of course I love you, Dickie Bird, better than a great silly boy. Of course I do. Then, oh, it was frightening. Gordon snatched the bird from me and wrung its neck. It was such a shock, I shall never forget it.
Her face had gone very pale.
And so you broke off the engagement, said Luke. Yes. I couldn't feel the same afterwards. You see, Mr. Fitzwilliam, she hesitated, it wasn't just the action. That might have been done in a fit of jealousy and temper. It was the awful feeling I had that he'd enjoyed doing it. It was that that frightened me.
Even long ago, murmured Luke, even in these days. She laid a hand on his arm.
Mr. Fitzwilliam?
He met the frightened appeal in her eyes with a grave, steady look. It is Lord Whitfield who committed all these murders, he said. You've known that all along, haven't you? She shook her head with vigour.
Not known it. If I had known it, then of course I would have spoken out. No, it was just a fear.
And you never gave me a hint.
She clasped her hands in sudden anguish. How could I? How could I? I was so fond of him once.
Yes, said Luke gently. I see. She turned away, fumbled in her bag, and a small lace-edged handkerchief was pressed for a moment to her eyes. Then she turned back again, dry-eyed, dignified, and composed.
I am so glad, she said, that Bridget has broken off her engagement. She is going to marry you instead, is she not?
Yes.
That will be much more suitable, said Miss Wainfleet rather primly.
Luke was unable to help smiling a little. But Miss Wainfleet's face grew grave and anxious. She leaned forward and once more laid a hand on his arm.
Be very careful, she said. Both of you must be very careful.
You mean with Lord Whitfield?
Yes. It would be better not to tell him.
Luke frowned. I don't think either of us would like the idea of that.
Oh, what does that matter? You don't seem to realize that he's mad. Mad. He won't stand it. Not for a moment. If anything happens to her,
nothing shall happen to her.
Yes, I know, but do realize that you're not a match for him. He's so dreadfully cunning. Take her away at once. It's the only hope. Make her go abroad. You'd better both go abroad,
Luke said slowly. It might be as well if she went. I shall stay.
I was afraid you would say that. But at any rate, get her away. At once, mind.
Luke nodded slowly. I think, he said, that you're right.
I know I'm right. Get her away before it's too late.